ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hi, Sarah Kanoski here. I recently sat down for a conversation with the former Prime Minister of New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern. We talked about her upbringing as a good Mormon girl, her unusual path into political leadership, and how she navigated some of the most terrible events in the history of New Zealand.
I felt such rage. That part of the way they designed this horrific attack was to try and get people to react violently.
Hear my conversation with Jacinda Ardern now by searching for Conversations on the ABC Listen app.
Welcome to Late Night Live, coming to you from Mianjin, Brisbane. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in for David Marr. In 1810, a young Indigenous woman from South Africa was trafficked to Europe under false pretense, where she became a freak show exhibit, gawked at on public stages and in private homes. She's remembered as a quintessential example of colonial exploitation. The writer Sasonke Msimang joins me later to reclaim her legacy. But first...
So our job as Russian patriots, and this is what I call upon my compatriots to do all the time, is to be mobilised and be active in defending Russia. Some people, they think, oh, well, you know, assimilation and so forth, and we can't do much to help Russia. We believe that it's not enough just to be Russian. You must support Russia. You must actively support Russia, and you should defend Russia.
In 2021, the ABC's Four Corners aired an episode called Putin's Patriots, which looked at Russian groups such as the Australian Cossacks, you just heard from leader Semyon Boykov there, who is these days living inside Russia's Sydney consulate to escape arrest. Another was a gang called the Night Wolves. It's a Kremlin-linked, far-right Russian motorcycle club that has a chapter in Australia. My next guest is a specialist in how Russia uses not only the online world, but how boots-on-the-ground communities like these are used to assert political influence. Dr. Olga Boychak is Senior Lecturer in Digital Cultures at the University of Sydney. Thanks for being here, Olga. Just tell us, who are the Night Wolves and how active are they globally?
The Night Wolves are a motorcycle club, but unlike the other motorcycle clubs that have this kind of countercultural nature to them, they started as one, but soon they evolved into pretty much mouthpieces of the Kremlin. So they started back in before the fall out of the Soviet Union in the late 80s, and they really were inspired by the other motorcycle clubs like Hell's Angels, like the Bandidos. But very soon they kind of switched, and they started being ardent supporters of Vladimir Putin. So after Vladimir Putin became president of the Russian Federation for the first time in 2020, they were seen on many different events supporting Vladimir Putin, that they were organizing rides to support Dmitry Medvedev. And in that way, they kind of became those mouthpieces of the Russian propaganda. They now have over 65 chapters in Russia. They have chapters almost all around the world, including a few chapters here in Australia. And the main things that they have been noticed or involved in is basically propagating Russian influence in their countries of operation. They've also been noticed in orchestrating pro-Russian insurgencies in various places. So that is what they're occupied with in the current moment.
And they gained some notoriety, didn't they, back in 2014 with the annexation of Crimea?
Absolutely. And that is a very interesting story because it starts many years before Russia occupied Crimea. It starts probably in 2010, if not earlier. So in 2010, they were known to organize various events, particularly working with youth in Crimea. They were organizing things like concerts, things like summer camps, where they did some patriotic education of the young people in Crimea. And so in a way, that became sort of a premonition that has set the fertile ground for the subsequent Russia's annexation of Crimea. And that is, in a way, positions them as almost those riders of the apocalypse or riders of the things that might be yet to come.
Tell us why the European Union has sanctioned some members.
For a number of reasons. There might be some legal reasons to sanction individual members, but on a broader scale, because their work in propagating the Russian influence has been considered a security threat. And that is the reason why some of their rides, so they have an annual ride celebrating victory, but framed in a very particular way. So they're celebrating Russia's victory over fascism, and they have this joyride where they attend kind of all of the significant places where battles took place, and they commemorate and celebrate basically the Russian contribution to defeating fascism. But what is really important here is that in their interpretation, fascism is a feature, is exhibited by those who are Russia's enemies. And by that logic, anyone who is the enemy of Russia in the contemporary time is a fascist.
So I guess we really need to point out that they haven't been outlawed or sanctioned here in Australia, although they have been in the US and Canada.
Yes, and I think that still provides some room for maneuver. But I think what is so interesting in the Night Wolves and in many other similar cultural or countercultural communities linked to the Russian Federation is that they act as a sort of micro-influencers in the political space. So influencers are well known in the kind of marketing space, right? They are increasingly used by companies to sell us different products. And in politics, they've increasingly been employed to propagate political views, political values, political beliefs. And this is something that is really interesting because in this space, the more authentic an actor, the more believable they are, the more their audience wants to emulate them. And they become these really natural spokespersons, if you will. And what is also really, there is an interesting paradox with influencing when it comes to authenticity, because the more followers an influencer has, the less authentic they are perceived to be. And I think each and every one of us has encountered this phenomenon in our own social media circles. The more kind of people we have following us, the less freely we can speak, the more kind of the less authentic we may seem. And so this is where some of those micro-influencers, people who don't really have large followerships, people who have under 10,000 followers, are really effective in spreading some of the messages because they take them as their own and they're perceived by their audience as authentic. And so this is what Russia increasingly uses to propagate its political influence in Western democracies in particular, is these kinds of boots on the ground, but also using them as communicative actors to propagate those ideas and beliefs.
Do you think all of them are directly linked with the Russian state, or do some of them, as we heard in the grab at the beginning, do some of them just feel that because they are Russians, they have this duty and they end up doing the work of the state without necessarily being state-sanctioned operatives?
I think it can be both. I think it wouldn't be right to claim that every Russian patriot, as they call themselves, are necessarily, you know, on a Russian paycheck. And I do think that people join and become propagators or Russian supporters for multiple reasons. But I do think that with regard to the Russian diaspora, it's really interesting to think about those things because the Russian diaspora is known to assimilate. And this is something that makes them very different from many other national communities, which really maintain and support their identity when they move overseas. With the Russian diaspora, that is not a straightforward phenomenon. So a lot of them try to, join the country in which they live in ways to kind of not develop and not foster their Russianness. So this explicit desire to be proudly Russian at a time when Russia is committing horrendous war crimes in Ukraine, when Russia is involved in many other things, I think it just begs a question. So that is all.
Mm. Do you characterize the Australian Cossacks in the same way as the Night Riders?
They are surely an interesting community. They are a political actor. They are involved in perhaps in some of the networks of pro-Russian actors. I think now that Semyon Boykov is in the Russian consulate, I think they are still active. So a few days ago, I think it was the 11th of June, I was actually on my way from work riding a bus. And I remember looking out the window and seeing a giant face of Vladimir Putin looking back at me. And it was a bit of a surreal experience because I didn't know what to think of it. But I realized those were large billboards with Vladimir Putin's face plastered all over them that were driving past the bus, so just driving on the street. And then I saw that they were part of an information campaign, information operation, if you will, where a lot of them were driving through Sydney and being photographed at the backdrop of our key landmarks. So they were photographed right next to the Harbour Bridge. They were photographed right next to the Opera House. And those photos that were taken by these communities have been used in those operations. So they were shown to the domestic audience in Russia saying, look, you know, we can do whatever we want in Australia. Here's one of our, you know, acts. And then they were also used to foster maybe Australian public support, showing that there are those who support what Russia is doing and kind of normalizing the support for Russia in public spaces.
So one of the ways in which you say Russia tries to exert political and cultural influence is through promoting the Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. Explain how they use his work.
Yes, so it is not only through promoting Pushkin, it is overall through the promotion of Russian culture. And it's often coupled with the adjective great. So oftentimes we encounter the phrase great Russian culture, which I think should be suspicious on its own, just the way that it's kind of framed. So the great Russian culture, the sort of classical Russian culture, that would be Pushkin, that would be Dostoevsky, that would be Ballet, that would be Tchaikovsky. So all of the kind of things that traditionally are associated with Russia have been for many years and are increasingly used to promote Russian cultural influence. And I think it is really done with a strategic purpose. And the strategic purpose is to promote a narrative that Russians are very civilized people, that they that their culture is very sophisticated, and that creates this uncomfortable duality. Because at the time when Russian atrocities have, you know, come to the fore, when they've been well documented, when there we know what has been happening in the territories, Ukraine's territories that are currently occupied by Russia, and at the same time there is this high kind of definition of culture, and so this duality, pretty much what it says, there is another Russia, there is this idealized vision of Russia, and then there is the Russia that's committing the war crimes. So in a way, it's an attempt to whitewash some of the very real things that are happening right now and to distract people from discussing them.
Do you think people are not able to hold those two ideas at the one time? You know, some of the great art and music and writing that has come from Russian artists is real and exists. But at the same time, we understand what is happening in Ukraine. So one doesn't need to eliminate the other, does it?
I do think that they're connected, though, because Russian imperialism has really thrived while a lot of minority writers, writers coming from places that were occupied by the Russian Empire and then by the Soviet Union, they got seriously oppressed up until the point of a lot of them lost their lives because they were public intellectuals, because they were creators who, you know, were Ukrainian or were belonging to one of the other minorities that were part of the Soviet Union. So I think this realization, this reckoning that the great Russian culture actually became so at the cost of a lot of other, you know, no less great authors and artists who could have perhaps produced also some really great works of art that we could now be admiring, is something that I wish people thought more about. And I can provide an example. So Ukraine's genius, Taras Shevchenko, he was a polymath. He was an artist who lived in the early and mid 19th century. And so pretty much when Leo Tolstoy was finishing his War and Peace, was submitting it for publication, Shevchenko died after he was, he was sent to labor camps for almost 20 years. That ruined his health. And so I think this contrast of someone who was so capable, who had so much potential, who could produce and did produce. He was a human rights activist. He was an artist, a painter, a poet. He had friends all over Europe at the time. He was a fashion icon. He was so many things that just never came to be because of the oppression that he experienced. And I like to think of that as one, just one of the stories in how, you know, that allowed Russian culture to be kind of raised on this pedestal. And I often think about it when I think of Russian culture.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes, filling in for David Marr, and I'm speaking with Russian disinformation expert Olga Boychak. Olga, tell us also about Vladimir Zelensky's new decolonization legislation. Or it's not that new anymore, I think was put in place in 2023. But how that has worked in pulling down, you know, monuments and memorials and these sorts of things.
Well, I think it's not necessarily coming from Zelensky, but it's also more of a grassroots phenomenon. I was actually an active participant of the Revolution of Dignity that happened in 2013 and 14, and I was present in Kyiv when people took down Lenin's monument. And I thought that was such a powerful historical moment of really unprompted people just realizing that Lenin is a marker of colonial oppression, that Lenin has no place in contemporary Kyiv, you know, in a prominent Bessarabska square. And so I think a lot of these, the taking down of monuments, of especially Russian markers of colonial identity, and Pushkin being very prominent among them, is a very much a grassroots phenomenon. People are trying to reclaim some of their lost history. They're trying to maybe pay more attention and elevate some of their own, you know, who they consider national heroes, some of their own creatives and artists who oftentimes even we don't know much about, because even in some museums around the world, they have long been considered Russian or Soviet. And that was also a way to erase kind of their Ukrainian identity, their contribution to Ukrainian culture. And I think overall, when we think of the role that Pushkin plays in establishing this colonial domination in the contemporary time, it's actually quite chilling. So when Mariupol, the city in the south of Ukraine, was occupied by the Russians, the Mariupol Drama Theater was one of the big places where people sheltered during the early days of the occupation. And there were between 300 and 500 people who were sheltering in the drama theater. They had a large word "children" written in the square in front of the theater, just to show, you know, if the planes are flying overhead, to kind of mark that theater as a place where civilians were sheltering. And it got obliterated from above. And this place of a mass atrocity, of a mass tragedy, Russia didn't keep it that way. Right now, the Mariupol Drama Theater has been rebuilt, and recently it had the first show that was shown in that theater. But what was really striking was that as it was rebuilt, as the scaffolding was erected around it, there were huge Pushkin's portraits all over that building. And so Pushkin tends to show up in the places that experienced a lot of violence, a lot of colonial violence, where it had to be erased and obscured and covered up. And so this is what really bothers me, is just understanding how Pushkin is used and how he's perceived, you know, our ability to celebrate him at the same time. So there was a cultural performance celebrating Pushkin at the Opera House recently, and I thought that was really, you know, somewhat tone deaf.
Yeah, so you're saying that, you know, these same sorts of using these sorts of things is happening right here in Australia too?
Oh, yes, absolutely. It's happening all the time, and it is happening through many different cultural genres and formats. It could be happening through Russian film, you know, showing, for example, showing Russian documentaries that were filmed in the occupied territories of Ukraine, where we know that no journalists have access to. So they were filmed by someone who was sanctioned and approved by the Russian Federation to be there. So a lot of these cultural events, they might not have a direct connection to Russia, but in promoting the Russian culture, they, you know, it's just a really problematic thing to do in the contemporary time when Ukrainian culture is being extinguished because literally the people who are the creators of that culture are being murdered.
Olga, these organizations that you've been talking about and how they use Russian culture and get a message out there, even in a micro-influential way, have any of them been investigated by the Australian government for foreign interference, or is it just speculation?
Not that I'm aware of. I do not have any knowledge of them being investigated. I think this is very much an internal matter. I do not think they are violating any laws in Australia in particular, at least not that I've heard of. I do know that Semyon Boykov had some, you know, he had assaulted an Australian citizen, so I know that much. But overall, I am not aware of any organizations being implicated.
When we look at the war more broadly, there seems to be significant discontent at the moment with Zelensky. And I imagine that, you know, many people are just sick and tired of the war. They want the war to end. That's not Zelensky's fault, but it has an impact at home, doesn't it? He's recently sacked his defence minister. But how do you see what's playing out in Ukraine at the moment?
Well, people are definitely tired of the war, but that doesn't mean that, you know, they want the war to end on just terms. Capitulation is not a victory, and so everyone understands that really well. And so no matter how hard it might get, last winter was one of the hardest ones to survive. It's really, it takes a lot of courage and resilience and I guess bravery to live through a European winter in a big city and also in other areas without, you know, when Russia was relentlessly bombing Ukraine's key energy infrastructure, when Ukraine was literally, you know, left without heat, without light, it is pretty incredible how people managed to survive and not only survive, but also extend support to those around them. And so I remember reading an account of a woman who was freezing in her apartment in the middle of the winter. And she was talking about every time that she, you know, that she felt like she was about to complain about her conditions and about the war and being, you know, growing fatigued and tired. She just remembered about, you know, the soldiers at the front lines trying to prevent Russian occupation, trying to repeal the Russian army. And so her way of channeling her, rage and her helplessness was to purchase a set of thermal underwear and send it over to the battlefront. And so she said, there are those who need it more than me, and I'm going to keep doing it as a way of resisting this. And so I think, yeah, there has been incredible resilience, which is not a very good way of portraying it, because people really are tired and they're vulnerable. But in a way, they understand that if they get occupied by Russia, the world has seen what Russian occupation means. And I think everyone understands really well that as long as, you know, Ukraine stands, people will be able to continue exercising their democratic governance. And I think what we're seeing, the popular protests in Ukraine at the moment, are very much indicative and illustrative of that civic spirit, where people agree to, you know, they go to protest against something, you know, this is essentially about government's accountability. And they do this at a risk to their own lives. But this is really important. And this is exactly the political culture that Vladimir Putin is so afraid of and that he wants to exterminate.
We know that elections are still on hold in Ukraine because of the war. Are you getting a sense of what might happen when that next election is held?
I think it is a complicated question, exactly because it is not possible to hold elections right now. And so this is a bit of a paradox where, you know, no matter how much people might want the elections to take place, it would still not be feasible or possible or practical or safe to, and it would also not be constitutional to organize them currently in Ukraine. So I think Ukraine resorts to other governance mechanisms that, you know, would allow, you know, change to take place. The current conflict between the Minister of Defense and the Ukrainian Armed Forces chief is unfortunate because Ukraine really benefits from unity at this historical moment in time. And so this is something that hopefully will be resolved soon. But as we see from historical examples, it's really fraught to be changing hands, you know, to appoint a new minister at a time when they would really need to learn on the fly. And so, yes, that definitely presents risks that creates, you know, that kind of misunderstandings create a dangerous precedent for Ukraine, and hopefully that can be resolved soon, just not to undermine all of the remarkable efforts that Ukraine is involved in.
So President Zelensky is in Washington at the moment and has just held meetings with President Trump and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Has that had any significant outcome for the war effort?
Not at this point. We know that they had some agreements. Right now, what is at stake is Ukraine being able to produce the Patriot interceptor systems, and that is one of the things that I know has been discussed. The reason for that is that the speed of producing those interceptor systems and overall the stockpile of weapons is dwindling, and it's dwindling really rapidly, especially with what is happening in the Middle East. So I do think that if Ukraine were to gain those capabilities, it would really allow Ukraine to provide air defense, because I know that is a major issue. There are the attacks by Russia on Ukrainian civilians. They get worse and worse, and every time it is harder to imagine what might be a worse attack, and yet they intensify. There are more weapons used. There are different kinds of weapons used. And so the Patriot missiles are really, the Patriot interceptor systems are really one of the things that can provide the security Ukraine needs, particularly with regard to civilians.
Yes, well, we talk a lot about the war effort, but it seems a conversation without an end, sadly. One hopes that it does happen sooner rather than later. Olga, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Tracy.
That's Dr. Olga Boychak, Senior Lecturer in Digital Cultures at the University of Sydney. She's a media sociologist who explores how communities can build resilience when digital technologies are weaponized. Coming up, the legacy of trafficked South African woman Sarah Bartman. Sarah Bartman spent her life being looked at, measured, and judged. Taken from South Africa to Europe in the early 1800s, she was exhibited as the so-called Hottentot Venus, her body exploited for entertainment and later used to justify racist pseudoscience that shaped attitudes towards black women for generations. In her new Griffith Review essay, Defending the Dead, writer Sinsonke Msimang asks us to look beyond Sarah's suffering. She explores how Bartman's story has been reclaimed and reimagined, from the fight to return her remains to South Africa to fierce debates over monuments, museums, and who has the right to tell her story. Author Sinsonke Msimang, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you so much. Great to be with you, Tracy.
Tell me, who was Sarah Bartman and what made you want to write about her life?
So Sarah Bartman was a Khoi San woman who was born in what is called the Hamtoos Valley in what was then the Cape Colony at the southern tip of Africa. And she was a woman who was a maid, born almost a slave, and she was living in the frontier of what was then the Cape Colony in the late 1700s. And because she was living in a world that was rapidly changing, where white people were arriving on the subcontinent and indigenous groups were being decimated by many things, a combination of war and disease, a story that we're all very familiar with, she finds herself kind of in this crucible and makes her way to Europe. There are questions about whether she chose to get on that ship or whether she was coerced onto that ship. And as you said in your introduction, finds herself for 5 years living in Europe, paraded in freak shows, and really becomes emblematic of what we think about Black women's bodies today, but also finds herself in the middle of this debate that European scientists are having about what is a human being and where do Indigenous people fit within that story of what a human being is. So she's seen as the missing link. So for all of those reasons, I find Sarah Bartman a fascinating character, both because she seemed like an interesting person in her own life, on her own terms, as well as because of what she then symbolized.
And the 5 years that she spends in Europe, arriving in London in 1810, 5 years later she dies in Paris from an unknown illness. What do you know about the time that she spent there?
What we know is that she got on board a ship called the Diadem, HMS Diadem. And this ship, she's accompanied by two men. She's accompanied by a man called Alexander Dunlop, who was a surgeon who was employed by the colony in the Cape of Good Hope. And we think that they came to know each other because there are suggestions that Sarah Bartman was a sex worker. You know, the Cape at that time was full of soldiers. It's around Napoleon Bonaparte's time. So there's French and British soldiers who are docking all the time. So it's a busy place and there's slave markets. So it's a real hubbub of a place. And so we suspect that she was a servant, but also that she was working on the side as a sex worker. And so because of this, she would have encountered the surgeon many times, because what they would do is they would take women and they would quarantine them until they had given them enough, you know, tablets for their syphilis to clear up, and then they'd be out in the city again, right? So we think she came to know Alexander Dunlop in that way, and she's accompanied by Hendrik Caesars, who is her employer, who is a free Black man. A free Black man means he had been a slave, he, through some way or another, becomes freed, and he essentially lives in the Cape, you know, almost like a white man. So these two men take Sarah to London. And when they get off the boat in London, they head straight to Piccadilly. It's bustling, it's buzzing. And this is a time when there are many exhibits, right? People in the colonial empire, in the heart of empire, are interested in what's happening in the colonies. Who are these people? Who are these savages? And so she's paraded as a savage. You pay a couple of pennies and you go in and you watch Sarah. And what happens when you watch her is she's essentially naked and you get charged an extra fee if you're allowed to touch her, right? And so men and women are in these rooms, they're packed in, there's drinks, there's commotion, and Sarah is kind of prowling the stage, quote unquote, acting like what they think a savage is. So that's immediately she goes to London and that's what her life is.
And she also
I feel like I need to pause for a breath because there's so much information to tell.
Well, do you want to pivot? Do you want to pivot to Paris? Was Paris any different?
Well, what's interesting, let me just finish London, because what's interesting that happens to her there is that she gets paraded and it, like, it's in all the newspapers and people are talking about her because they've never seen anything like this, right? She has a big bum by, you know, Western standards. And they can't stop looking, right? And they think this is a completely different structured kind of woman. And therefore, is she a woman? Like, what actually is she, right? And because of the amount of talk and chatter there is, a bunch of abolitionists hear about her. And so they take her case to the king's bench and they say, she's actually here under duress. She's a slave. We don't trust, you know, the auspices under which she's here. Who is this Henrik Caesar? And who is this white guy who's with her all the time? And so the king's bench sits and they, it's one of the earliest court cases actually around, you know, human labor. And Sarah doesn't speak English, obviously. She speaks Dutch and she needs an interpreter. And she essentially says, because those two men are there present when she's being asked, she says, actually, I'm here of my own free will. I've got a 5-year contract and I'm going to go back in a couple of years once I've made enough money. So it's fat. But what that does is it cools off the interest. People kind of get scared off the kind of voyeuristic pleasure. And she ends up touring the UK, doing a bunch of different academic tours. So people then start looking at her as an interesting scientific exhibit. So that's how she ends her time in the UK. And then she goes to Paris.
And was Paris the same?
Paris is different because in Paris, you don't have the same environment of the kind of abolitionism. Remember, she gets to the UK in 1810, and it's in 1807 that the British government has outlawed the initial outlawing of slavery. It took a long time, but 1807 is when they first do that. So people are kind of anxious about this, these new slavery laws. And there's no similar vibe in Paris. So she gets to Paris and there she's sold essentially to an animal trainer. And there she's put in the zoo. So there's no pretending in Paris. The niceties are kind of stripped away. And she is shown in a zoo and she prowls around. And again, they're huge crowds and it's a very miserable life. And so her health really begins to decline very quickly once she gets to Paris. But once again, as in the UK, she's also an object of interest and fascination by all these scientists. They're trying to figure out, what is she? Does this represent what they call the missing link? That quote-unquote indigenous peoples around the world. Of course, the Europeans are indigenous in Europe. But in any case, they're trying to figure out, like, what is this specimen? And this man called Georges Cuvier, who even to this day is kind of known as the father of evolution. He does a lot of interesting scientific work before Charles Darwin does. And he's very, very interested in her lifetime. He asks her several times to come to his rooms for inspection, and she refuses, which I love that about her. But eventually she declines, her health declines. And when she dies in the late in December 1815, the first person who finds out about her death is Georges Cuvier, and he says to her trainer, to the animal trainer, not to her trainer, to the animal trainer, he says, I want permission to do an autopsy. And so he does the autopsy on her body.
But the autopsy didn't really tell us what she died from, did it? I mean, I can imagine it was a whole host of things, not the least of which her life and the misery that she was experiencing. But what sort of pseudoscience did he put forward about Sarah's body after the autopsy?
Yeah, exactly right. We still don't know the actual cause of her death, in spite of the fact that, you know, he swooped in and did this autopsy. What he was interested in instead were her parts. So he wanted to examine her genitals. He wanted to examine her buttocks. He did a cast of her body, and then he essentially dismembered her. He broke her up into parts and pickled her genitals, and then made a frame of her skeleton. And then he wrote this long report, like a 30-page report, which essentially looked at her skull as well and said, her brain and her skull and her physical stature tell us that she lies in between the orangutan and the human. Mm-hmm. And so this phrasing that we also hear here on this continent in Australia about this quote-unquote missing link, we hear this about quote-unquote Hottentots, we hear this about Aboriginal people, they refer to this missing link. And this is what he determines where Sarah Bartman fits in the firmament of humanity. And this lingers, of course. It has a long, lasting legacy.
That's exactly what I was going to say. Yeah. How long did those ideas carry influence, either in medicine or science, or even in popular culture today?
Yeah, they permeate. I mean, I think we still see lots of ways in which they permeate to this day. But certainly in the scientific world, you see medical textbooks and, you know, biology texts continuing to use Cuvier's language and wording at least for the next 100 years. So if you look back at old textbooks, you'll see him referenced and you'll see these references to the missing link. So they stay around for a really long time. And what also stays around for a really long time are her remains in the Museum of Natural History in Paris. So they exhibit her, the cast of her body, and they display her skull for many, many years. And in fact, it's only in 1974 when a member of the public says, huh, hang on a minute, is this okay to be displaying this human being's body and remains in this way, that the museum sort of twigs and says, ah, actually, maybe we should stow this away. And so her remains are then put out of public view, but the museum continues to hold on to her body, her body parts for many years after that.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm Tracy Holmes, and I'm speaking with the writer Sosonke Msamung. Sosonke, then this 1994 campaign to return Sarah's remains, becomes evident, was a remarkable international effort, but there were real tensions, weren't there, between the French and the South Africans?
Exactly. So 1994, apartheid ends. Nelson Mandela becomes the president of South Africa. And there's this real hope and energy. And South Africa is this amazing place that everyone kind of wants something to do with, right? And so President Mitterrand, then president of France, does a state visit. And in that state visit, Nelson Mandela says to him, you have one of our ancestors. Her name is Sarah Bartman. This is her story. And we'd love you to return her to us, because some Khoi San ancestors have been sort of mobilizing and saying, you know, we want her back. And so this campaign begins. Mitterrand says, of course you can have her back. And there are some very testy conversations that happen with the head of the museum at the time, who says, essentially, no, we're not going to return her, despite the fact that you, Nelson Mandela, are this, you know, incredible human being and everyone in the world loves and respects you. We're not going to do this. And, you know, after a while, it becomes clear that there's more than simply, you know, garden variety racism going on. What's actually happening is that at an institutional level, the remains of ancestors who are kept by museums are the property of the French state. She belongs to France. And if we want her back, we're going to have to change the law. And that means the French Parliament is going to have to change the law. And so the campaign kicks into a kind of another gear. And around the same time that this is all happening, there's a woman called Diane Ferris, who's a poet. At the time, she's studying gender and development, gender and colonization in Holland. And she hears about this story. And she's got the same ancestry of Sarah Bartman. And so she really puts herself in Sarah Bartman's shoes, right? And she writes this beautiful poem called I've Come to Take You Home. And it's
Sosonke,
about...
Why don't you stop right there? Because yeah. We've got the poem. Let's
oh, beautiful.
Play it. Yeah.
Okay, great.
I've come to take you home. Home. Remember the felt. The lush green grass beneath the big oak trees. The air is cool there. And the sun does not burn. I have made your bed at the foot of the hill. Your blankets are covered in buchu and mint. The proteas stand in yellow and white. And the water in the stream chuckles sing songs as it hobbles along over little stones. I've come to wrench you away, away from the poking eyes of the man-made monster who lives in the dark with his clutches of imperialism, who dissects your body bit by bit, but who likens your soul to that of Satan and declares himself the ultimate God. I've come to soothe your heavy heart. I offer my bosom to your weary soul. I will cover your face with the palms of my hands. Run my lips over the lines in your neck. Feast my eyes on the beauty of you. And I will sing for you, for I have come to bring you peace. I've come to take you home where the ancient mountains shout your name. I have made your bed at the foot of the hill. Your blankets are covered in buchu and mint. The proteas stand in yellow and white. I've come to take you home where I will sing for you. For you have brought me peace. For you have brought us peace.
Just incredible. The South African writer Diana Ferris's poem about Sarah Baartman, I've Come to Take You Home. So, Sisonke, did Sarah's story then get this newfound attention because of the way her life was captured in that incredible poem?
Absolutely. And so this new generation of young South Africans, and I was one at the time, heard this poem and joined this campaign. And essentially, at the end of the day, the campaign worked. And the government won out, South African government won out, and she came home. We sent a state airplane to get her, a delegation of women, including Diana Ferris, got on that plane and went to Paris and accompanied her body home, covered by the new South African flag. It was a profoundly moving ceremony, and she was buried in the Hamtus Valley in the east, what is now the Eastern Cape, which is where the archivists have figured out she was born.
How incredible to have that involvement in this story, Sisonke. But I want to jump to 2015 and to your alma mater, the University of Cape Town. How did Sarah Baartman come back into the public consciousness yet again?
Yeah, so part of why I love Sarah Baartman is because she has this long afterlife. So she lies resting, in this valley. But then in 2014 and 15 and 16, there's this movement that takes a hold in South Africa. And these students at the University of Cape Town, where I studied, in the early 2000s, see a sculpture of Sarah Baartman. And it's done by a sculptor called Willie Bester. And she's naked. The sculpture is of Sarah Baartman naked. And it's in the middle of a bunch of protests called the Rhodes Must Fall movement. Students have torn down the statue of Cecil John Rhodes, who was a colonizer, and they are looking around campus for symbols of colonization that they want to tear down. And Sarah Baartman's sculpture is there, and she's naked as she was in life. And these group of female students decide that they're going to cover her body. So they drape her in cloths and they cover her head with a sort of traditional African woman's headscarf, if you can imagine that. And the administration does not like this. And so this delicate kind of choreography begins where the administration takes off the clothing and the women put the clothing back. And the artist says, "You're censoring me." And the women say, "We are in conversation with Sarah." And it's a fascinating, I think, really creative demonstration on how to speak back to history in many ways.
It is fascinating, and there's no right or wrong answer, but where do you stand on this? Like, how do you resolve this issue when both are trying to celebrate the life of Sarah and they both take, different positions? Different. What happens?
So, what is interesting is that Willie Bester himself was a black man of Khoi ancestry, like Diane Ferris, like Sarah Baartman, who grew up under apartheid. And it was incredibly difficult for him to make art under those circumstances. He was working class and he grew up in the Cape. And so the fact that he was able to make art and has become one of the most well-known artists of this era, it says something. It's a testament to a kind of grit and resilience and talent. I think that the students, when they began to protest against his statue, his sculpture of Sarah, did not know that he was an African man. In South Africa, the name Willie Bester could just as easily be an Afrikaner. And so the protest was both of the art, but I suspect the protest was also of the artist, right? And so they made an assumption about who had done it. And I think they read her nakedness in a particular way because they assumed a white man had made this sculpture and he had reified, kind of is solidifying her exploitation and the gaze that was upon her in life. When in fact, Willie Bester was a black man who had been moved by the same poem we've just heard. He heard it when I heard it, when the rest of the country heard it, long before these students were born, right? And he walked around the Cape looking for objects. It's made of found objects, looking for objects strenuously for 4 months to piece together this beautiful, beautiful sculpture, right? Mm-hmm. And so I have a lot of empathy with him. And part of me is like, these kids don't know anything, right? But I also have such a profound empathy for these students who are, as I said, speaking back to history and who have adopted Sarah Bartman as a totem for exploitation and for a kind of way of being gazed upon, which still feels very present to them, right? And the act of caring for her by clothing her, by covering her, but not by removing her sculpture from where it was in the public domain, I think is really smart and really interesting, right?
It's very smart. I've often thought that when we have our own campaigns to tear down statues, like, wouldn't it be better to add to the art, to tell the story as we understand, you know, the elements that have gone into that and perhaps the history that was recorded at the time needs to be reviewed. It's fascinating. But a lot of your essay focuses on the battle over who gets to speak for Sarah. And ultimately, does that become an impossible question to answer, given that she was never able to speak for herself?
Look, I think that what becomes important is recognizing that we have no recordings of how she spoke for herself. But in life, we know she spoke for herself. And in some ways, that alone, remembering that historical figures who were silenced because the colonial archives didn't make space for them, because the only way that Aboriginal people here in Australia, that Indigenous people in many parts of the world, including South Africa, the only way that we got recorded was when we came up against the law, you know, in courtrooms, when we were criminalized, right? And so remembering that, I think, helps me to recognize that in her own way, in her own life, in her own terms, she did speak. And what's important for us who are here today is to not forget that. And so that we may imagine what her voice sounded like, not as a victim, you know, not as someone who is argued over, but as someone who existed as a human being in her own right.
As you say, asking readers to think about whose histories are preserved, whose are forgotten, how are they told? Do you think museums and universities are getting better at confronting these sorts of questions, or are they still struggling?
I think museums and universities are very much still struggling. But what I found in researching this article was that scholars and artists are doing some really interesting stuff. So I think that what's happening is that individuals are getting much better at imagining into the archive, if that doesn't sound too naff. But it's like you have these, you know, you have a university that has a library. And if you look at whose, you know, works are in that library, there's a lot of people whose works are not in the library. So you have to imagine. You have to reinsert, right? So you have to take the really small scraps of information that we have about someone like Sarah, and you need to frame a story around it. And so that's why I think the art piece is really, really important. That's why the sculpture, this stuff about what's in the public domain and what we celebrate, it comes from stories, but I think it's really important that we imagine more interesting ways to engage with, you know, what exists like in the public domain for us, whose histories get talked about. And then for the people whose histories don't get talked about, we have to be able to think about creative ways to insert them into the public conversation.
Wow, I think it's wonderful, because the whole idea of storytelling and, you know, recording our history from a multitude of voices as we all experience the same things quite differently. And your voice is very important in this as well, Sasonke. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Tracy.
I've been speaking with the writer Sasonke Msamung, who's written a piece on the life of Sarah Bartman in the latest Griffith Review. And that is the show. Thanks for joining me again. And thank you, as always, to the Late Night Live team. And get well soon, David. I'll catch you next time.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.